You're listening to West Texas Talk on Marfa Public Radio. I'm Diana Nguyen. Today, we have two guests who will be speaking as part of Agave Festival happening this weekend. Later in the show, Elise Peppel talks to artist and art historian Josh T. Franco. He grew up in Odessa and spent a lot of time visiting family in Marfa. They talk about the apparition by the Virgin of Guadalupe in Marfa, which took place in the 90s. The site is now commemorated by an altar at the home of Esther Sanchez. But first, I talked to archaeologist David Keller. He's the author of In the Shadow of the Chinatis, a history of Pinto Canyon and the Big Bend. It looks at the early ranchers who settled the area and examines the forces that have changed the land's use over time. As part of Agave Festival, he'll read at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, June 4th at the Crowley Theater. David, thank you so much for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
What made you first interested in researching the history of Pinto Canyon?
Well, honestly, you know, Jeff Ford, who's the owner, basically commissioned me to write it. He came to the Center for Big Bend Studies, and he'd been working with the center for about a decade, and they'd been doing primarily prehistoric research on the ranch. Mm. But in conversation with Bob Maloof, who was then the director of the center, Jeff decided that he'd be interested in having a history written of his ranch. And, of course, his ranch is much more expansive than just Pinto Canyon. But that's what the book ended up being about. Mm-hmm. And so he asked me to write it, and I said, heck yeah. You know, although I was commissioned to write the book, that wasn't my motivation to write it. My real motivation, and I toyed with this for a long time, I wasn't immediately just taken by Pinto Canyon for various reasons. I don't know why. It wasn't inviting to me at first. I didn't feel this warm and fuzzy feeling about it, mainly because every time you get off the road, you get attacked by cat claw. Or acacias or cactus of some kind. But there was something else, and it was, I think, ultimately it was the fact that all these houses and these structures were so vacant and just going back into the earth, which it felt like that history was just being erased there. And I had no connection to it, no sense of it. And so it became important to me to tell those stories, to discover the stories behind these fading ruins, and to share those with people. And the reason for sharing those stories is because stories imbue the land with meaning. And when the land has meaning to people, it tends to foster a sense of place. And that's really important to me. And so I think it's important for me to extend that to other people, to help them develop a sense of place, because I think ultimately that's what connects us to the landscape and ultimately allows us to desire to protect it. So that was a big deal. I guess the other thing that I would say about that landscape down there was kind of a predominant theme throughout the book, and that's that the land below the rim rock is dramatically different than, say, the Marfa Plain. The Marfa Plain is a sweeping grassland. It's really good cow country if it's properly managed. That land below the rim rock just isn't. It never was. It's extremely difficult, you know, to run it as ranching country. And the fact that it ever was run like that to any degree of success is remarkable. I like to think that the landscape itself became a central character in the book because it was it played such a major role in people's stories and the measure of success and failures that they had. This book is really, in a large sense, just a collection of stories. It's stories within stories within stories. And I think it's neat that they're all collected and sort of contained within this structure, which is Pinto Canyon. And stories are so ephemeral. They're so easily lost. And once they're lost, they can't be told. And if they can't be told, they can't be remembered. And if they're gone, there's nothing else except the land itself. Mm. Only the land remains. And I think that speaks to the stories. It also speaks to our human, the ephemeral nature of our existence. We're just passing through. And I think that when you look at it in the long run, in the long term, and you see that we're just passing through, it becomes important that we become good stewards.
Jose Prieto was a rancher of humble origins. He was from Mexico, and he came to Pinto Canyon in the late 1800s, and he ranched there for longer than anybody else. His life and family sort of ground your book. Why was he so important for you to focus on?
Well, I think Jose Prieto's story just eclipsed all others in that book. It was just, there was no competition. When I finally latched onto that story, when I learned that story, I quickly realized it was going to be pivotal. It was going to be the pivotal story in the book. It's an immigrant story. And it's a success story. It's an incredible success story. But it's also, you know, an epic tragedy. His life had so much success, but so much pain, so much violence that occurred that wasn't anything to do with him. It wasn't his own fault. But a lot of tragedy was, you know, befell the family over time. And so that was unfortunate. But it also, you know, lent this incredible scope to the story that a lot of the other stories just didn't have.
You write about how at the time, the Homestead Acts could be pretty exclusionary to Mexicans. Can you talk about that and how Jose Prieto was sort of able to build his ranch and figure that out?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. And I was very fortunate to, you know, to talk to his grandchildren, who basically, you know, cued me in on that. But it was difficult for people of Hispanic descent to file on land. Largely because, well, for one thing, there was prejudicial issues. But also there was a language barrier. Those acts were written in English language, and the people who worked at the front desk were often only English speakers. And so that presented a difficulty that for a lot of people was insurmountable. For Jose Prieto, it was not. And one reason it wasn't is because he befriended a man named James Wilson, who lived down in the canyon. And Jose had actually come to James's rescue, as he was wont to do. Jose was a very kind man. And James Wilson had had a bad accident. He'd gotten kicked by his horse, his leg was broken, and they had just moved into the canyon. And so it was a complete worst thing at the worst time. Three little girls to take care of, a wife, his sister-in-law, and suddenly he's in bedridden, you know. So Jose Prieto watched over his herd, brought the family groceries, you know, during the months that he was convalescing. And so they became quite close. And when James was better, he taught Jose Prieto how to file on land and basically released his potential.
And the ranch grew and grew over years, right?
It did, yeah. So it started about 1908 with three or four sections. And by 1928, he had 19 sections. So very, you know, it wasn't a really meteoric growth or anything like that. It wasn't really fast, but it was steady, and he was a good businessman, and so it was he made smart decisions and was able to buy that land over time such that he owned it outright.
He weathered a lot, the Mexican Revolution, droughts, but you kind of alluded to these really tragic events in his life, and that kind of happened because of mounting racial tensions along the border and the rest of the country. What was happening socially by the end of the 1920s? Because it seemed like life in the canyon was maybe kind of peaceful between Mexicans and Anglos up until this point.
It really was, you know, and it was interesting because Pinto Canyon had its own school that opened around 1910. Mm-hmm. And it was a mix of homesteaders. We had Anglo families, we had Hispanic families. And it was one, these ranch schools like Pinto Canyon were one of the few schools in the state that weren't segregated. And so I think that had an equalizing effect. And also the fact that Jose Prieto in particular and others down canyon, the Nunezes, were very upstanding people, very successful. They were savvy businessmen. Mm. And so they garnered respect. And just their, you know, in Jose's case in particular, his kindness generated a lot of empathy from people. People really respected him. They liked him. And so he got along really well with his neighbors. There was a lot of harmony at that time. No stories of anything but harmony back in the days. It started to change, of course, with the Mexican Revolution. There was a lot of back and forth banditry that mm-hmm. happened. And so a lot of mistrust was engendered. And I think it fueled a lot of sort of racism that became entrenched and eventually came to a head in Pinto Canyon in a certain incident in 1934. So,
right. So James Sims Weatherby was a sort of neighboring rancher who moved in, and he did not get along with one of Prieto's sons. And his move kind of disrupted the social fabric, the peaceful social fabric that existed. What happened?
Well, you know, I don't know everything that happened, but what we do know is that Sim Weatherby and his family moved into the canyon, I think around 1928, so it was right before stock market crash, before the Depression. And so it was a bad time to be getting into ranching, especially mm-hmm. in the lowland country of Pinto Canyon, where it's very difficult. And so, you know, what happened, I think, he was a neighbor to the Prieto family, and they just got crossways. And I think the large part of that was Gregorio Prieto, who of all Jose Prieto's sons was not the most congenial. He tended to be pretty harsh in his words. He was quick to anger. He was never one to turn down a fight, and he wasn't going to take any kind of abuse from a white guy. He didn't really like white guys to begin with. And Sim came from another sort of social environment where Hispanics were relegated to a second-class, you know, status. And I think that that really just was the cause of this disagreement that really got out of hand. It got badly out of hand.
And it resulted in one of Jose's sons dying. Can you talk about that incident?
Yeah, it was 1934, so, you know, right in the middle of the Depression. And I think that that was probably a contributing factor. There was a lot of stress. There was a lot of, you know, loans that couldn't be paid. People were really having a hard time emotionally. In the midst of all this, Sim Weatherby claims that a shot was fired at his vehicle when he was passing the Prieto ranch. But it was where Gregorio was living at the time with his wife. So Sim drove by. He claims a shot was fired at his vehicle. So he goes to Valentine and gets the Texas Rangers to follow him back into Pinto Canyon. And it's in the middle of the night by this time, and they knock on the door. Gregorio answers the door. And without a word, Sim Weatherby raises his shotgun and shoots. Gregorio wheels, runs back, you know, trying to head back into the house, but he's hit in the back, in his back, and thrown to the floor. And his wife, Pilar, slams the door shut, and he's, you know, manages to get in. And the Texas Rangers and Sim Weatherby retreat to the creek bed. And for some reason, the Texas Ranger wanted backup, decided that he needed backup at that point. He claims that he didn't know how many people were in there and that, you know, the walls were too thick. So they did. He had this guy go drive back to Marfa, get his regular partner and come back. And by that time, Gregorio's wife had run through the night to the Prieto house to try to find help. And when she got there, the only person who was there was Pablo, who was Jose Prieto's youngest son and also probably his most promising son. He was the only one that had gone to high school. Mm. He was attending the Lydia Patterson Institute in El Paso. He just happened to be home for the summer, and he was there. And so, of course, he got up, got dressed, followed Pilar back to the house, and was rendering aid to his brother when the Rangers came back. And what they did that time is they didn't bother to knock on the door. They knocked the door down, and Hale, who was the Texas Ranger, and his partner stormed into the house. They saw Pablo sitting there by his brother, and they shot him and killed him. And so Pablo was killed in cold blood. Of course, it went to trial soon, and the whole question hinged on whether or not Pablo was armed. The family claimed he was not. Hale claimed that he was. And in the end, the jury found Hale not guilty. And so it was a terrible tragedy, but I think also it probably, for the Prieto family, felt like an incredible betrayal, you know, of their fellow citizens.
And I think it's important to mention Sim Weatherby, the neighbor who kind of started this whole thing. His case was dismissed, right, in a different county.
That's right. Yeah, it did go to a different county, and it was also dismissed. It was the second time he was on trial for murder or attempted murder, and was acquitted. So he got off scot-free.
You say that the 40s were the last good decade of ranching in Pinto Canyon. Why is that?
Well, it was largely because of the war and because of the market. You know, wool and mohair were bringing a lot of money at that time.
People are mostly running sheep in Pinto Canyon.
That's correct, mm-hmm. Sheep and goats. Pretty much wool and mohair were the two main commodities. It's just not real favorable country for cattle, and the sheep and the goats got along better. But also during World War II, you know, the entire Big Bend, there was an incredible explosion of sheep and goat ranching because the market was so strong for those commodities in order to provide wool for uniforms. Mm. And so it was a you know, this incredible rise in the market just caused everybody to stock the land to capacity. Very fortunately, the weather was cooperative, and they had ample rainfall in the 40s, and so things were, you know, looking really, really good, you know, at least until the war ended, and the commodities began to decline.
In the 50s, there was the seven-year drought, and that seemed to have long-lasting effects on what was to happen in Pinto Canyon. Can you talk about that drought?
Yeah, it was the worst drought in 300 years. No one was prepared for it. And so it was basically the sky forgot to rain. It just it got drier and drier and hotter and hotter. I think people who lived through or who were here in 2011, for example, might get a sense of what the 50s was like. If you can imagine that times 4, 5, or 6, or 7 years of that, that's what we're looking at. Ranching down in Pinto Canyon below the rim rock was always more challenging than above. To add drought to that, especially a long-lasting drought like the 50s, was devastating. Livestock started to die. There was no market for them anymore, so you couldn't really sell them. If you did, you sold them at rock-bottom prices. And the ones that you kept, you couldn't hardly take care of any longer. There was not enough food on the ground, not enough grass for them to eat, and not even enough water. Only the houses at that time had windmills, and there wasn't a lot of live water. And they had to literally put water in barrels, 55-gallon barrels, and drive them around the ranch to troughs, to these bleeding sheep and goats that were literally dying. The ones at the end of the line that couldn't get to the water because they were too weak would just fall in the sand and die. And it was devastating for ranchers because these were the animals that they were entrusted to care for.
It seems like the land after that drought couldn't really recover.
No, it can't. You really can't recover from that kind of intensive drought when you've got it especially coupled with grazing. It's very, very difficult because once some of those changes are set into motion, they're largely irreversible unless you put an incredible amount of labor or energy into the system to try to bring it back. And what we're looking at is the loss of grasses and topsoil. So the productivity of the range declined dramatically. And, yeah, it was something that the range has never fully recovered from and never will.
And so there was this era of ranching, and then we start to see this shift in Pinto Canyon. Maybe the first sort of iteration of the shift is the 70s when Donald Judd arrives and starts purchasing land. And over several years, his holdings grew to 40,000 acres. How was his perspective on conservation and land management different from what had been happening before, leading up to this point?
Well, Judd, of course, you know, came from a completely different background. He didn't have ranching or farming in his background very much. I mean, he had certainly spent time at his grandparents' farm, and that was meaningful to him. But the main thing was he didn't need the land to make money for him. Mm. He did not require the land to turn a profit. And so he had the luxury of owning land without requiring it to turn a profit so that he could afford the luxury of being a conservationist. And he was. He was very conservation-minded. And very respectful of history, too. And that's one thing that I've found very striking is about how he was able to take care of those houses out there in such a thoughtful way and to restore them pretty well with true fidelity to what they once were. So Judd was a completely different type of landowner that came, and it hearkened a shift in land ownership in the canyon for sure.
And then the sort of antithesis of that was the arrival of A.J. Rodd, who was a millionaire who purchased the old Sheely Ranch, and he turned it into a hunting ranch for himself and for his friends. Can you talk about him and just kind of what he was doing there?
Well, Rodd had become a great success in the machine tool cutting business, and so made money in a completely unrelated industry. So he came from a completely different background. His wealth allowed him to buy land. His main interest was hunting. And Pinto Canyon was just another investment. It was just another, he had other ranches in Central Texas, just kind of a hobby ranch, a place to play around on and to bring your buddies to go hunting. As far as I could tell, didn't go out there a whole lot, just during hunting seasons, and that was about it.
And it seems like kind of to the disdain of neighboring ranchers, He was putting roads in on his ranch so he could shoot animals from cars and what have you and not really get out and walk, it seems like, which angered a lot of people.
Yeah, especially Judd, but I mean, a lot of people, including the Sheelys who sold the ranch, they didn't have any idea that that was in store. And so they had these, I think, these big Jeep vehicles with high-mounted seats and that kind of thing to drive around in. And I think it just made hunting more of a sort of a luxury endeavor where you didn't have to expend an incredible amount of energy. But, yeah, a lot of people saw that as destructive and disrespectful, including Judd.
And that ranch that Rod owned was later bought by Jeff Fort, who is the current owner and who commissioned this book. What happened once Jeff Fort took ownership?
You know, after Jeff took possession of the land, grazing largely ceased, for one thing. I mean, he had a small herd of longhorns that he's kept, and I think there's still a few out there. But over time, he really had a conservation vision. He wanted to conserve the land. He wanted to protect it. And so he got into conversations with the Nature Conservancy and the NRCS, and he put Pinto Canyon in a riparian conservation easement, which is one of the most important things you can do on land is protect your riparian areas. And then, of course, as he continued to acquire more land, some of those sales came with stipulations of conservation easements, which he was definitely in line for. So,
yeah, he ended up buying the Judd properties at the request of Flavin and Rainer Judd. Can you kind of talk about how that worked out?
Yeah, so, you know, Judd died and left this incredible, swath of land down there that he'd been acquiring during the, last couple of decades of his life. And was really, I think, one of his greatest passions was that land down there and purchasing it and protecting it. And so when he died, it was his dying wish that that land be protected, either made available for research and study or for people, for recreation, but definitely protected. He didn't want to see it damaged in any way. And so that was a pretty big charge that his kids inherited. They had to find someone who would be willing to buy the land, but also to put a conservation easement on it, and other things that a lot of landowners wouldn't want to agree to, which is, they retained the three houses on the ranches and 40 acres around each, and then, of course, access to those houses. And so it would take a unique buyer to be willing to address all those different concessions, and Jeff was. And so I think they, made a pretty strong pitch to him to buy it.
It's kind of interesting. Jeff's work has sort of been a continuation of Donald Judd's work. He's been a huge part of what the Center for Big Bend Studies has been doing. That's the archaeological arm and historical arm of Sol Ross. He's allowed the center to study many prehistoric and historic sites on his land. How do you think about these huge cultural changes that have happened from these sort of days in the late 1800s until where we are now, 150 years later? And what does that mean, I guess, for the greater Big Bend, thinking about the way land ownership is shifting into this thing, and maybe a luxury, like you mentioned, where people don't have to turn a profit on their land? Is it a good thing, ultimately?
Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. I think it's both good and bad. You know, I have it's complicated, and I have mixed feelings myself about it. I think in a lot of ways it is good, because it is, a lot of people now don't require the land to turn a profit, and so they have the luxury of being conservationists. And in cases where they're able to buy big enough parcels, that's a very meaningful thing. It's protecting great swaths of wildlife habitat, riparian areas. I think in that way it's very beneficial. It's a good thing. But you're also losing something. You know, there's a cultural side of things, a cultural legacy of ranching here that is getting lost. And I think that's a little bit lamentable. I mean, I think most people have a little bit of nostalgia for the old days and for the ranching ways. I know I do. And so it's a mixed bag.
In talking to so many ranchers doing this research, I guess, what do you hear from them? Is it the same sort of lamenting of of this maybe cultural, of this culture fading away?
It is one. It's a very predominant theme for sure, especially with the Prieto family, because they lost so much. They didn't only lose, you know, family members throughout history, but they also lost their ranch, which was an incredible loss to the family. And that, of course, that happened in the early 70s and was a result of infighting within the family. Kind of like Chip Love said, quote that I used in the book, ranches don't fail, families fail.
Mm.
And it was a failure of family that that caused the Prietos to lose their ranch. And that was very sad to them. I mean, a tearful thing. When they come back now, you know, that landscape and those houses all have so much meaning to them, for their parents, for their grandparents. It's hard for, I think, people who are city dwellers or suburbanites to understand that level of connection to place. And when that's taken away from you, it's a devastating thing. So there is always that. There's always a measure of lamenting in these stories. And the fact that you can't go back, you know, there's just no way. So, yeah, it's very common. I did speak to a lot of landowners or children and grandchildren of landowners who made this history. And they were all very happy to talk about their stories, because those stories were so rich, and they all were very proud of playing a role in Pinto Canyon's history, as they should. It was a hard place to make a living, and those people who were able to were remarkable.
My guest is David Keller. We've been talking about his book, In the Shadow of the Chinatis, A History of Pinto Canyon in the Big Bend. As part of Agave Festival, he'll read at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, June 4th at the Crowley Theater. I'm Diana Nguyen. David, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Diana.
Coming up, Elise Pepple talks to artist and art historian Josh T. Franco about an altar to the Virgin of Guadalupe in Marfa. Stay tuned. West Texas Talk. Up next, a conversation between Elise Pepple and Josh T. Franco. He grew up in Odessa and spent a lot of time visiting family in Marfa. He's an artist and is the national collector at the Archives of American Art. Franco is featured in many of Agave Festival's events this weekend. At 2 p.m. on Saturday, June 1st, he'll talk to Santa Barraza and Kay Turner about agave-related spirituality and home altars of the borderlands at the Crowley Theater. Also at the Crowley on Sunday, June 2nd at 6 p.m., Franco will talk with Cheech Marin about his life in art, as well as his advocacy for and the collection of Chicano art. Afterward, Franco, Santa Barraza, and Kay Turner will lead a procession from the Crowley Theater that will end at the site of an apparition by the Virgin of Guadalupe in Marfa, which took place in the 90s. The site is commemorated by an altar at the home of Esther Sanchez. More about the altar in this conversation. Here's Elise Pepple and Josh T. Franco.
For someone who doesn't know about the altar in the Sanchez's backyard, could you tell the story of this?
So Esther Sanchez and her family live in the house where my grandfather grew up as a child here in Marfa. And they've been there for a long time. And in the 90s, the Virgin of Guadalupe appeared in the tree trunk in the backyard at night for a couple of weeks as a white shadow. And Esther has a VHS recording of this. It's really convincing image. You see her there. She moves her hands from prayer to openness and back and forth. And when she stopped appearing to mark the site of the apparition, Hector Sanchez, who was alive at the time, and the family and friends built the altar to mark the site. So it's, you know, they used a bathtub, they attached rocks to it to embellish it, and then it inside is a statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe that they bought from a factory. It was white and they hand painted. And then there's also a little grotto dug in front of it, which is nice. You can look at the Big Bend Sentinel at the time and Rosario Halpern's article about it. Esther kept a log of the people who came to visit. Word got out through the Catholic Diocese newsletters and things like that. So pilgrims came from Mexico and from New Mexico and from here. There's one person from Italy in the notebook, which is nice. Yeah, so it's a heavy pilgrimage site here in Marfa that has nothing to do with other pilgrimage sites people associate the town with, I think.
Yeah. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your research that you've done about Marfa.
Yeah, definitely. So I wrote my dissertation about this town, and specifically an altar to the Virgin of Guadalupe is kind of is a main object in that dissertation. I was raised Southern Baptist, so Guadalupe wasn't a part of, you know, how I was raised, except that she's also like kind of always there if you're Mexican or Mexican American. So I really delved into what she means, you know, politically, spiritually, in my adult life. And then a lot as a result of what I was doing, writing my dissertation about Marfa. So I grew up coming here a lot to visit family on weekends and things from Odessa. But I didn't know Judd was here or his work was here until I was in my early 20s. Even though my grandfather's childhood home is literally next door to Chinati. We're a working class Mexican-American family. When we came here, had nothing to do with coming to see Judd or quote-unquote high art. It was to see family, and it was, you know, I was a kid, so it was pretty boring to me. So I just had no idea. And then in around, I guess, 2009, a friend of mine who I did my undergrad art history degree with had an internship at Chinati. You know, and the interns stay there, and there was a rule then, maybe still now, that they're allowed one overnight guest during their internship. So I was going to be out here anyway during the summer, like back in Odessa with family. Nobody else was going to be out here, so my friend Claire said, you'll be my overnight guest. So I came, so in our, you know, early 20s, 21 maybe, and I came, and like I said, I had no idea about Judd's presence here, but because I was staying with her at Chinati, it was, yeah, I drove in and immediately was inside Chinati with her, which was kind of a trauma because it's this place you think you know very well, but then you learn there was this huge, huge presence in a place you thought you knew very well that you never knew about before. Yeah, so it was strange. And then I was with her and the other interns, you know, and she's Anglo, and they were, I think it's all Anglo too, and I was with them moving around town, and people like, you know, wouldn't speak Spanish to me like they normally would have if I were here with my family. Yeah, it was like a total switch just because of who I was moving with and the spaces I was going to with the group of Chinati interns rather than with my family.
Yeah.
So just like identity crisis, and then the dissertation was kind of just like therapy over 6 years. I gave
yeah. And you were telling me that your dissertation was about the relationship between minimalism and rascuachismo.
Yeah, you said it perfectly.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, the other thing, too, is when I did see Judd's work, I loved it. It just hit me in the gut, and, like, I still love it. You know,
What do you love about it?
It's presence, you know, to use a very loaded art historical concept. But it's not simple work at all. And, you know, minimalism is a word Judd wrote about. I don't think any artist who's called a minimalist really ever took to that. That was definitely an invention on critics and art historians' parts. So I don't feel like I love the simplicity is not something I think about. I think it's incredibly rigorous, hard. Where did this come from? Work.
Mm-hmm.
I like that it declares its own presence. It allows me to feel very present in relation to it. And I think that's, you know, the fact that I'm having trouble putting words to it is why I love it so much, because it's like a life project to understand what the work is and to unpack why it gives me that visceral feeling. So I love the work, but I also understood that, you know, because of Judd's move here, it's complicated. You know, the tax base has increased and like relatives can't afford their homes anymore. And so I have a lot of complex feelings about what Judd's move here did.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, maybe there wouldn't be a town if Judd hadn't moved here. That, mm-hmm. You can't ignore that fact either. So there's all those factors. And then, and like I said, this crisis that I just kind of needed to unpack. So then when I learned about the altar in the backyard of my grandfather's childhood home that the Sanchez's take care of and built, it occurred to me like rascuachismo is around too. So rascuachismo is a term that signifies Chicano aesthetics. It's a term that's been around since the 20s, at least in literature. But the scholar Tomasi Badafrausto really brought into academia or the art world in the late 80s with an essay he penned and an exhibition he curated. So it's really about like making do with what's at hand. I think it's something that, you know, Rainer Judd has called DIY in interviews. Somebody else whose name I'm forgetting is called like the cowboy way. So it's something that in West Texas, we all, it's a matter of survival, but then Rascuachismo is also about like creativity beyond that as well. So like the altar to Guadalupe in the Sanchez's yard, you know, using a bathtub turned upright to provide the housing for the altar is a very Rascuache move.
You were explaining kind of visually when you were telling me about your dissertation, the location of where all these things kind of collide or overlap physically. Could you kind of describe that to me?
Totally. So there's a traffic circle here in Marsha that is like the most loaded traffic circle because you have on it, there's the Border Patrol headquarters, Marfa Public Housing, the first set of gates to get up to Chinati offices, and then my grandfather's / the Sanchez's home.
Yeah.
So just psychologically, energetically, there's a lot happening there. So because of where it is, the Guadalupe altar's in the backyard of the home, and Judd's outdoor 15 concrete works are in the landscape, you know, at an angle. So they like live in this kind of eternal locked sight lines of one another, which is like, for an art historian, when I realized, you know, where they are in relation to each other, it was just gold to me. Like, it's like, this is a super dense situation that you can write about
for
a couple hundred pages.
Yeah, and you did.
And I did.
Yeah.
One chapter is all about how we define sculpture and then what it means to put domestic altars, you know, spiritually motivated altars and altars in general into the sculptural conversation in art history.
Right. Yeah. And what does it mean to put altars
into sculpture? It means you have to pay attention to race and ethnicity in a new way. It means you have to value knowledge that's built around spiritual thinking. And those are two big things.
Yeah, those are big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's, and then another chapter is about pilgrimage. And I did, one exercise I did in my research was just to like, you know, I was always had my Google alerts and capturing the mentions of Marfa in popular press, which, you know, it shows up in, for better or worse, / worse, constantly in New York Times and Vogue and W. So I kept a log of those, and then I kept a subset of all the ones that used the word pilgrim or pilgrimage, which is a lot of them. And then, of course, people coming to Guadalupe in the Sanchez's yard is also a pilgrimage.
Right.
So one chapter is about, like, what do these two notions of pilgrimage do when people are actually in town?
You know,
and either encountering one another, ignoring one another.
Can we talk about that? What do those pilgrimages in the same place look like or do in this town and in the larger world?
You know, people certainly come to the art, the Judd generated art. There's definitely a group of those people who have a lifelong interest and investment in art history and post-war American art and Donald Judd in particular, or any of the other artists, you know, represented in his collections. So, but putting them aside, there's definitely increasingly more of a group of people who come to see the art that are kind of doing their capital C cultural checklists.
Birding.
Like, I did Spiral Jetty, I did Burning Man, I did Lightning Field, I did Marfa, that checklist. It's another thing to consume. And then, so you can say you did it, take your selfie in front of Prada Marfa, you're done, move on. But I don't think that's really, like, possible with the Guadalupe. Like, you're either invested in Guadalupe and that's why you come, or you're not. I don't think she's part of any kind of checklist in that way. So the, like, whether or not you have a lifelong investment in the pilgrim, in the reason you pilgrim to Marfa, is probably something that marks people differently. Yeah. It's interesting. And, you know, you can tell.
Okay. But interesting is one of those words that's like, nice.
Yeah. Well, here's a very concrete way. So I did have this conversation too with an art historian, Dario Gamboni, based in Europe, and he's thought about Marfa a lot and done writing about Marfa. We had an exchange once about the act of making offering.
Uh-huh.
So at Guadalupe, people leave something when they visit her, uh-huh. whether it's a little toy or a little coins or a candle,
mm-hmm.
Along with whatever you're asking her for. But people, when they go visit the 100 aluminum works or the concrete mm-hmm. works, you know, they don't leave things. But he countered with, well, the act of them going there is the offering,
mm-hmm.
which has to do with, I guess, what I was saying, like people, the localness of the people who care about Guadalupe
mm-hmm.
is a fact, like they're local. Even if they're New Mexico or Mexico, that's pretty local here.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely relative to anyone from New York or Europe or Japan coming here.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess he's right. Like, yeah, they're not making a big sacrifice as far as moving across space.
Mm-hmm.
So they leave an object, but the people who come from much further afield to see the collections at Chinati, for instance, are probably making a really big break from their lives
mm-hmm.
to come here, much bigger than the people coming from just the border to see Guadalupe.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he's right. You know, maybe they do leave something. They leave their time.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful image in my mind's eye to see kind of two pilgrimages
yeah.
in the same space,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily touching, but in the same small town.
Yeah. And then they touch and like throw you into crisis. but I did, you know, my dissertation was an installation work before it was ever anything written.
Huh.
And so my dissertation I worked on from 2011 to 2016, but from 2009 to 2011, it was working on creating and exhibiting the installation Marfita,
mm-hmm.
Little Marfa. And one of the things that was really important for me to do too was to enact the double pilgrimage. And we were like, must be the first to do a conscious double pilgrimage to Marfa,
mm.
to both Guadalupe and Judd, because we're all artists trained in Texas. And when you're an artist brought up in this state, Judd's like always going to be talked about to you. And you always ask, like, well, have you been to Marfa? It's compulsory, you know, to come here. Like the architecture students at UT, they'll have to come here
mm-hmm.
as part of their coursework. So we did that. And that was great. We were like, we're going to do the first conscious
yeah.
double pilgrimage. So we did, and it was, yeah, I think it tested a lot about our attachments. And, you know, Joshua's a white man, Allison's Chinese American and white woman, but all Texan. You know, Texan identity is strong, as I'm sure you've figured out by now.
And I noticed that.
Yeah, we really love being us. What it showed us, you know, it totally changed how Allison was thinking about her contribution.
Hmm.
So Marfita was made of four parts, and it was very tongue-in-cheek, the initial premise that stayed. It was just like, how do we create a miniature Marfa where Guadalupe has much more presence than Judd? So I spent about a year in a metal shop creating miniatures of the 100 aluminums, which is super fun. And I built the miniatures of the sheds also. And Allison built a replica of the Guadalupe that was about three times as big as the
mm.
original.
Mm.
So she didn't make one smaller, make one bigger.
Mm.
And she was, you know, she was thinking about a sculpture of Guadalupe, but then she came here and realized, you know, we visited the site in the yard, and she was just like, I think she felt that distinction. She's not a person with a lifelong relationship with Guadalupe, and she felt a little bit of a crisis about trying to represent her. So to be true to that non-relationship, a very new relationship to that figure, what she ended up producing was the altar structure, you know, replica of the bathtub. But then inside it, she just played a film on this little plexiglass screen that was me and her and Joshua just basically running around Marfa, both in the yard and at Judd, but also like in the playground at the elementary school and just playing with things that are in the physical landscape here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really beautiful. You know, she's like, there's an absence here because I don't have a relationship with Guadalupe and I'm not going to pretend to.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a relationship to Texas and Marfa because I'm an artist trained here.
Mm-hmm.
So we just really, yeah, the video is us inhabiting Marfa in just funny, playful ways. And she played that in place of the statue. And that was inside the gallery. And then Natalie Goodnow, she came on for the opening in particular. She's a Chicano artist based in Austin who works with danzantes, so people who practice Nahuatl dances and ceremonies. Mm-hmm. And she brought her group, and they led the people at the opening, I think it was about 100-150 people, on the procession to honor Guadalupe. So they led us out of the gallery, around the block in East Austin of Collab, and then back in the gallery. We weren't only thinking about the politics of Marfa, but the politics of East Austin as well. And Sean Gallagher, who's founded Collab, is very aware of who he is and what it meant for him to be in the neighborhood he was and what he meant for him to make, generate art there. It has similar issues to Marfa. It's a really Mexican-American neighborhood, but mm-hmm. when none of the immediate neighbors ever cared about what happened at Collab or went in to see. And that was something that was always on Sean's mind. So, but when we did the procession, all these little kids came out because they were like, what's happening? And yeah. Natalie is like, es un procesión para la Guadalupe, para la Virgen. And then they were like, they understood that.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, and then they got their parents like, it's a Guadalupe procession, let's uh-huh. go. So it was totally like they joined the group and then they came back into the space with us to close the ceremony at the altar. And it was like the first time they'd been inside Collab.
Huh.
Much like as part of my research, too, from Orfitas, I wanted to bring my grandfather, who grew up here, into Chinati, which he had never been in. And doing that was amazing, mm-hmm. bringing my grandfather into Chinati. It was a trip for him. It was a trip for us. And yeah.
What was the trip about it?
Just the same thing, I think, probably even deeper for him because he grew up here, is that he just remembers it being like a kind of defunct or half-active army base, mm-hmm. Hearing scary stories about the German prisoners of war that were kept there. Somebody's drawings were on display. And they're super subtle pencil drawings, and he was just stared at them for a really long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he was thinking, but it was a really interesting moment. And I think he was just having, he didn't say a lot of words. It was just, I grew up here. What is this here? It's like finding an alien in your home.
That was a conversation between Elise Peppel and Josh T. Franco. Franco is featured in many of Agave Festival's events this weekend. At 2 p.m. on Saturday, June 1st, he'll talk to Santa Barraza and Kay Turner about agave-related spirituality and home altars of the borderlands at the Crowley Theater. Also at the Crowley on Sunday, June 2nd at 6 p.m., Franco will talk with Cheech Marin about his life in art as well as his advocacy for and the collection of Chicano art. Afterward, Franco, Santa Barraza, and Kay Turner will lead a procession from the Crowley Theater that will end at the site of an apparition by the Virgin of Guadalupe and Marfa. Earlier in the episode, I spoke to David Keller about his latest book, In the Shadow of the Chinatis, A History of Pinto Canyon and the Big Bend. As part of Agave Festival, he'll read at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, June 4th, at the Crowley Theater. More information about Agave Festival can be found at agavemarfa.com. I'm Diana Nguyen, your host and producer. You've been listening to West Texas Talk. You can find the archive online at marfapublicradio.org, or you can subscribe to the West Texas Talk podcast on iTunes. Thanks for listening.